And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander, the journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
You've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast, where I, Paul Spataro, am joined by my two very, very good buddies, Mr. Andrew Leyland.
Hello!
And Mr. Sean Engel.
Hello, everyone.
To go over every episode, one by one, of the way underrated series Deep Space Nine. When last we left you, we had just completed Season 1, and we were on the brink of Season 2, which we're going to start today. And I'm excited about moving on into the series. As much as I enjoyed Season 1 at points, I feel like we're going to start getting a little bit more of a consistency going. How are you guys doing, and what do you think?
Fine, and I agree entirely with you.
Yep, I have to say the same, especially looking at these first two episodes, or actually the first three episodes that we've got of the second season. It looks like they're starting to get that feel of doing a sequential storytelling and having a sort of overall, you're working towards that goal of an overall story arc that's running through the series. This first episode, I think, is going to be really interesting. It expands on what we had in the first season. It brings forth some more of the ideas of religious conflict on Bajor. It brings the Vedix into the story again. It's starting to get... It was good in the first season. It's starting to get even better.
Yeah, I agree. But before we get into our episode... I think we would be remiss now, as we record now, you know, we've had a slight layoff, even though it hasn't shown in the release schedule. So it's old news for us now, and by the time this is posted, it's going to be even older news. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least dedicate a part of the show to Leonard Nimoy and Harv Bennett and talk about how, you know, how they impacted us. And I would say, for me, you know, in particular, Leonard Nimoy, because I'm far more well-versed on Leonard Nimoy than I am on Harv Bennett. But Leonard Nimoy, to me, always presented as you can be a nerd and cool at the same time, or you could be a geek and cool at the same time, even before it was cool to be a geek. Like, he you know, he wasn't a particularly physically imposing guy, but he played the guy, you know, who had the strength of, you know, 12 Vulcans plus 2. He was intelligent in a cool way. The lack of emotion in his actions, I don't know, just set him apart as being cooler than everybody else. He was almost the Fonz of Star Trek. And
he could make things just by hitting him.
Yeah. But even you know, I mean, I can't say I've seen a lot of Leonard Nimoy in things that weren't Star Trek. You know, you had Mission Impossible, but you had, you know, not in a character role, but you had In Search Of. But that's really the non-Star Trek Leonard Nimoy that I've seen. But he still always, even when he wasn't playing Spock, still had that same type of cool demeanor about him. And when he passed away, And I, you know, I figured, oh, I want to put something up on Facebook. What I put up was him singing Bilbo Baggins.
Yes.
Because I thought that kind of, like, showed it. You know, he's not being Spock. He's singing this silly song, and yet he seems so cool throughout it. And that just, you know, to me, that's what he was all about for me. And that's what I enjoyed. And you know, I know he was, I think, 84 years old or 83 years old. So, you know, it's hard to term that as a tragedy. But it is saddening, and you know, his contribution to the world of pop culture certainly touched my life, and I'm saddened by his passing.
Yeah, I was quite amazed by the effect that it seemed to have. You forget how important this silly little 60s TV show was to people, and I was. Just the outpouring of grief and the tributes that came from really unexpected places, especially given, you know, you expect it in America. Star Trek's a big thing in America. But to have the President of the United States give a eulogy, irrespective of what side of the political platform you live on, that's how much he impacted pop culture. And even over here, it was everywhere, and people were paying tributes, and there was articles in newspapers and magazines, and it was, you know, it wasn't a shock. We kind of expected it when it announced he'd gone into hospital, but it was still a little bit of a gut punch, because my all-time favorite episode is A Mock Time. I mean, I always think, to me, Star Trek's Captain Kirk, but my favorite episode's a Spock episode, and he's brilliant in that. I mean, the performance I saw that is non-Trek related that stuck with me is Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, I forgot that.
Which I actually think he's very good in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And he does manage to not be Spock in it. And I sometimes think he kind of got over it, but it did overshadow his life. And it doesn't seem like he particularly was bothered about it once he got to a certain age. And he made his peace with it. And he seemed like, from everything everybody was saying, there's not been any... Nobody's come out and said anything about him in a negative light, even before he died. He seemed like one of those guys who was genuine. I mean, Adam Baldwin, who was in Firefly, even posted he met him only once, and he said it was a really lovely conversation he had with him. And that just seemed to be the general impression from everyone who'd only even met him once.
Yeah, it kind of hit me hard as well. To pull back the curtain, in my family, both my parents passed away in February, and having Leonard Nimoy, who my mom was very much in, she was very much into getting me into science fiction. She took me to see Star Wars when it came out. She took me to see Star Trek the Motion Picture when it came out. She came with me to see all the Star Trek movies, and in fact, she passed away just before the first J.J. Abrams movie was supposed to come out, and she was actually talking to me, you know, in hospital before she passed away, saying how much she was looking forward to that. So Star Trek has always had a great meaning to me, and my mom really instilled the character, the love and the character of Spock into me, and I really think he embodies the best of what kind of geek culture or nerd culture, he embodies the best representation of it. He's cool under pressure. He's intelligent. He is strong. He can quip against anyone. He always has a great comeback. And outside of the character of Spock, he's done other acting roles. Like I said, you said, Andy, Invasion of the Body Snatchers was a great movie. He's done some directing work. I know he did the Three Men and a Little Baby, and as along with the two Star Trek films. You know, he even did. I know Scott and Chris did the tribute to him where they talked about the Bruno Mars video where he was just hanging out and having an average day, and even at his age he looked like he was having fun with his life. And you know, it's really one of those kind of sad things to know that he's gone, even though it's not unexpected. Yes, at 83 years old, you know, your time's kind of limited, but you know, it was, he made an indelible impression on geek culture, and it can't be dismissed in any way.
See, Harv Bennett's kind of different because he's behind the scenes more than anything, but I think it's fair to say he saved the franchise. You know, Star Trek The Motion Picture, we all think is a great film, but the general perception of it was not successful in terms of capturing the spirit of what Star Trek is for a mainstream movie-going audience. And Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, did. Now, Nicholas Meyer did an awful lot of that as well, but it was Bennett that brought Meyer in.
Mm-hmm.
And Bennett is also responsible for the $6 Million Man television show. I mean, he didn't create it, because obviously it's adapted from a book by Martin Caden. But after the three telly movies, only one of which is any good, Bennett came in and saved it from Glenn Larson getting his hands on it. And certainly the first two, three seasons of that show are really, really good. And I think as Bennett lessened his control, the quality control went away.
But Bennett had his hands in all of the original series movies, didn't he? Even up to number six, I think.
No, he's nothing to do with six. He walked away.
He walked away
after his Starfleet Academy idea was rejected, because his theory was, you know, I don't have to have Star Trek in my life. If you don't want to do the one I want to do, I'll just walk away, which is fair enough. And he went and did Time Tracks. Do you remember that?
I remember maybe. The name.
Yeah, it's a sci-fi show in the late 80s, early 90s, I think, with Dale Midkiff in it. It was, you know, it was okay. It was entertaining enough.
Yeah, I again, that's what I left Harve Bennett for you, because I'm not quite as well versed on it. But I do, and we talked about it when we did our Listen to the Prophets episode a little bit, that the thing I remember is the talk of Nicholas Meyer and Harve Bennett sitting down with all the episodes of the original series before doing The Wrath of Khan and taking notes on every show about what works, what doesn't work, what's good, what's not good, and really trying to work that into The Wrath of Khan. And again, you know, I don't want to go into repeating ourselves, but I think so much of that carried over to The Search for Spock as well. And I think Nicholas Meyer gets the credit for that, but I think it really should be dual credit. I think, you know, Harve Bennett was every bit as influential on that movie as Nicholas Meyer was.
Well, and wasn't Bennett the one who initially came up with the idea of the mind meld with DeForest Kelly to extend it in case they wanted to do a sequel? I thought that was the case.
Yeah, that was him. It was him who came up with the basic idea of bringing Khan back. That was Harve Bennett's idea, and they had a couple of different scripts. And then he hired Nick Meyer, who took the scripts away and just essentially did a page one rewrite, taking bits from each one and compiling a complete script out of it.
Hmm. That was so much better than the original idea, which Star Trek II, The Wrath of Elan of Troyes.
Oh, I don't know. I'd watch that.
You'd be one of them then.
I'd be the one of them.
But yeah, it's sad when, you know, our sci-fi icons pass away, but they've given us such great memories and such great shows and such entertainment that, you know, we really want to salute them, and we really want to thank them for everything that they've done to not only enhance Star Trek culture but enhance, you know, geek culture as well.
Well, I think certainly the original will run forever at this point. We've no reason to think it won't do. It has become a classic in the sense that, you know, it's actually quite good if you watch it with an open mind. There's a reason that it became what it became. It's actually a really good show. There's a reason it's still running 50 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the reason that Star Trek still has an influence today, to, if I can boil it down to a nutshell, which I don't think really is the way to do it, because I think it's too much more complex than I'm going to make it sound. But I think the reason that it has the lasting impression that it does is not just because of the acting, and it's not just because of the types of stories they discussed, but I think it's because it was a little bit of ahead of its time, or maybe a lot of ahead of its time, in the way they dealt with the characters and the intelligent way they looked at the stories. They didn't just throw things together for the sake of, hey, we'll make an episode and then we'll forget everything that we did. It was not a linear continuing story, but they did try to always have an internal logic to it that science fiction of the day didn't always do.
Yeah, there's a vast difference. There's a reason why Lost in Space isn't a franchise and Star Trek is.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly what my point in one sentence.
All right, well...
Anyway. But, you know, I guess in our own way, we're dedicating this show to the passing of those two gentlemen who touched our lives. And now we can move on to season two of Deep Space Nine.
A dangerous mission.
I can't loan you a Starfleet runabout without knowing where you plan on taking it.
To Cardassia 4 to rescue a Bajoran prisoner of war.
If we don't leave now, Major, we never will.
To rescue a reluctant hero.
They still need you. But I am not the man that they think I am.
Exposes a secret society.
They call themselves the Circle.
That threatens to destroy the Alliance. Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
And season two opens up with The Homecoming, which is part one of a three-part episode directed by Winrich Kolbe, and the teleplay is by Ira Stephen Baer, story by Jerry Taylor and Ira Stephen Baer. The show aired on September 26th, 1993, and features guest performances by Richard Boehmer of West Side Story fame and Frank Langella. And here's our story. Quark gives Kira a Bajoran earring, which she immediately recognizes as belonging to Lee Nalis, a Bajoran war hero long thought dead. Lee is being held on the desert planet Cardassia 4, so Kira requests a runabout for a rescue mission. Sisko tells her he will consider it, but while he considers the matter, O'Brien discovers graffiti from an extremist faction called the Circle, who want to expel all non-Bajorans from Bajor. Seeing this convinces Sisko that Bajor needs a leader like Lee Nalis, and he grants Kira the runabout. Kira and O'Brien, disguising their runabout as a Lesepian transport, travel to Cardassia 4 and discover a labor camp with more than a dozen Bajorans. O'Brien pretends to solicit Kira to one of the soldiers, tricking him into lowering the force field that surrounds the camp. They rescue Lee and several other prisoners. Before Kira and O'Brien return to DS9, Gul Dukat contacts Sisko to inform him that the Cardassian government has issued a formal apology and that the remaining prisoners are en route to Bajor. Bajor's provisional government, on the other hand, chastises Kira's actions because they might have resulted in war with Cardassia. DS9's Bajoran population greets Lee Nalis as a returning hero. Sisko and Kira urge him to help bring stability to Bajor. But shortly thereafter, Lee is caught trying to stow away on a departing freighter. He relates to a puzzled Sisko that he never wanted to be a hero. He killed a Cardassian out of necessity, and his fellow Bajorans eventually turned him into a legend. Sisko convinces Lee to stay, because Bajor needs a legend like him. After a trip to Bajor, Lee Nalis returns with Minister Jaro Essa of the Provisional Government. The Chamber of Ministers has invented a new title for Lee, Navark. However, the title means little. Seeing Lee as a threat to their power, the politicians have made him liaison officer to DS9 and promoted Kira to Bajor, where they believe she can do them no more danger. I thought this was a good but not great intro into a three-part story, although I do really, really enjoy the political intrigue of it, which is something that's building on last season, and kind of seeing that the positives that they could take story-wise and running with them a little bit, which I really do like. I enjoyed the episode, but there's something about the multiple-part episodes that always leaves you just a little bit, it's hard to just discuss them singly. But that's what we're doing. So, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought it was a very low-key introduction to the season. It's not in any way not enjoyable or bad. It's actually really, really good. But, yeah, and you're kind of left dangling at the end with all these plot threads.
But it's not like a huge cliffhanger. It's just we're going to continue.
It's low-key, isn't it? It's typical Bajoran political intrigue, which I understand turned a lot of people off the show, but us, as fans of it, we quite like all of this stuff. I did like the Lee Nalis character. I liked the idea that he became a hero by accident. and has no particular desire to be this historical figure.
He's the legend. Man who shot Liberty Valance.
Exactly. He is. Exactly right. He's Liberty Valance. And it's just, it's such a good idea to do because Kira's already put him on a pedestal.
Yeah, I have to agree with you that it wasn't as spectacular as of an opening of the season as the pilot episode was. We've already established all the characters. We know what their motivation is. It's an interesting idea that after all this time, that the Cardassians are still holding this one political prisoner, and this political prisoner is such a heroic icon to the Bajorans that Kira believes that rescuing him would basically turn all the turmoil going on the planet, would basically sort of end that, and that's the motivation for this three-part story in general.
Mm.
But yeah, it's just kind of set up for what's going on. And like you said, I do enjoy the fact that this person who's been built up to be this magnificent hero, this person who's supposed to be the savior of Bajor, is nothing more than a guy who was in the right place at the right time.
Or the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, that's probably a better explanation, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did very much like that. I liked that Kira is also so naive that she thinks this guy will just give Bajor somewhere to rally around, whereas we know from both real life and from Deep Space Nine's portrayal of the political situation on Bajor, the individual factions will just use him to their own personal gain. It won't be about reuniting all of Bajor. It will be about us versus them. And as it develops, we actually see that's what comes to pass.
It becomes, how do I use him to gain power, or mm-hmm. how do I set him up to keep him from deteriorating my power?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
I'm sorry, go ahead, Andy.
I was just going to say, I do like that we've seen this side of Kira before. She is politically quite naive. Well, she's got past this idea of being a freedom fighter, she doesn't really know how politics works. She's got one view of how it should be, but there are people on the planet that are, they're probably working towards the same goal, the reunification of Bajor and building Bajor up to be a powerful presence after they've been decimated by the war, but they have their own agendas for doing what they're doing. The best person to put in charge of Bajor would be Kira, because she doesn't want the job.
You know, she wouldn't be, because, as you say, she is somewhat naive. And I don't think it's naive like, oh, I don't think people are bad, but I think she thinks all of the Bajorans have the same goals as she does.
Yeah.
And I don't think she realizes, and again, I guess this would be naivete, I don't think she realizes how much people I was going to say Kai Winn, but it's not Kai.
It's Vedic Winn still.
Vedic Winn. She doesn't realize how much she would be willing to compromise her values to get more power. And we'll learn that more as things go on. So I think ultimately she would fail as any type of leader in Bajor, because she would be taken advantage of, because she would think people's motivations are pure as her own.
Well, and I think
true. Good point.
I think that's one of the things that's interesting about Lee Nalis, is that she's held him up to this same standard that she has, and unfortunately he's not in any way near that. He's just a person who happened to kill a Cardassian at the wrong time. And Kira is trying to put this idea, this sort of idealistic attitude that she has on him, and it's not really working for him because that's not who he is. And that probably also plays into her naivete of her thinking that all Bajorans think like she does.
What I liked about Lee Nalis is he isn't your stereotypical, oh, we thought he was a hero and it turns out he's a villain. You know, there wasn't that. He is of pure motivation, but he doesn't want the limelight. He doesn't want the spotlight on him. He doesn't believe he's a hero, and he believes that everybody's built this up too much. Again, the man who shot Liberty Valance. Mm.
And he's also not a coward necessarily. They could have played
exactly.
That. He's not, you know, I didn't want to do this. I don't know what I'm doing. He's wanting to do what's right. He's just not the kind of person that his mythos has built him up to be.
He's humble. and he isn't, you know, he knows that the stories that have been told about him aren't true, and it's not of his doing. It's not that he was trying to build himself up. All in all, it's just, you know, I think he's a pretty deep layered character for a guy who we're only going to see for a short time. No spoiler intended. but, you know, I would have welcomed him as a regular to this cast. I think he's quite a good character, and all things considered, I was looking at him and I'm saying, who is this guy? I recognize him. I've seen him before. And his big, you know, his big thing is he was Tony in West Side Story. And it's almost unrecognizable to pick him out from that, but that happens to be one of my favorite movies. I love West Side Story. I'm not a huge musical guy as far as movies go, but I've seen that movie as a kid, and it's always stayed with me. It's always been one of my favorites. So I like I said, I would have welcomed him to the cast as a regular for the whole season and longer, but you know, we only get him for a short time.
Wasn't he in Twin Peaks?
He was in Twin Peaks, but that was not a breakout role for him. Interestingly enough, he was in Twin Peaks, as was, I think it's Riff from West Side Story.
It's been a long time since I've seen West Side Story, so. I was impressed that they got Frank Langella in the cast. I think he, unfortunately, I don't think we'll be seeing much of Frank Langella after this three-part episode, if I recall, as well. But Frank Langella isn't he's almost on the level of Louise Fletcher as Vedic Wynn, and I think later in the next episode we'll see them working together a little bit, sort of behind the scenes, and the political machinations of those two characters really, it's what sets apart Deep Space Nine from the rest of the Star Trek shows, is they're willing to talk about these things like politics and religion and how they play together and how they manipulate one another and how they work together to try and coerce people. And like I said, I was really happy to see Langella in the role, even though it was uncredited.
What a coup it must have been when they said, hey, I got Skeletor.
Or soon to be Barry White.
He is a far better actor than playing Skeletor would lead you to believe. He became famous, at least to me. I first learned of him when he was playing Dracula on Broadway.
Now, did that lead to him playing Dracula in the, the 78 or 79 film?
Yes.
Okay. See, because I remember, I didn't know he played it on Broadway. I also, I don't know if you remember back in the day, Paul, they used to have these Broadway plays that HBO would do. And I think he also did a version of Sherlock Holmes on one of these HBO adaptations. And he was really good in that, so... It's nice to see Frank Langella, regardless of what he's acting in.
Yeah, I'm gonna read to you a little bit from his Wikipedia page, where it says Langella would continue to juggle film and television with his stage work, playing Sherlock Holmes in a 1981 adaptation of William Gillette's play Sherlock Holmes. He repeated the role on Broadway in 1987 in Charles Marowitz's play Sherlock's Last Case. The same year, Langella would also portray the villain Skeletor in Masters of the Universe.
Two sides of the same actor.
Yeah, essentially, Holmes and Skeletor, they're basically one and the same, aren't they?
it's like the, I remember talking with Scott and Chris and Mike Bailey, I think it was on Comics Monthly Monday, and we were talking about the episode with, Abe Lincoln and Genghis Khan. And doing them as the odd couple, and you could kind of do Sherlock Holmes and Skeletor that way too.
Oh, that'd be...
Oh, Skeletor, you make such a mess.
There's a couple of little good character bits in it. It's not all about the guest cast. There's the brilliant bit in the middle where Kira pretends to be a prostitute and O'Brien's her pimp.
Now, I've got to say, you know, not that I have a lot of experience with what prostitutes wear, but I didn't think Kira was perhaps the most frumpy prostitute I think I've ever seen. I mean,
she's the grandma pants prostitute.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, she's got mom pants, so yeah, not the sex. Well, unless you're into mom pants, but you know, there are all kinds of fetishes. Why not?
It didn't hide her figure. So.
No, she was very attractive, but you know, when I think prostitutes, I think far less clothing. But, you know, maybe the Cardassians like clothing. So, there you go.
I also don't have a lot of experience in that field. In fact, I have none, thankfully.
Methinks you both protest too much.
But I would think if it were real, it's one of the things where it's just... I know they're trying to get him to open the force field and let them in and all. But I'm thinking that they were almost a little too quick to say, yeah, let it come over to you. If it were real, I think they'd be a little bit more reticent, like, no, you know, you're the authority figure. I don't want to go to you. Like, almost make him pursue a little bit more. He was saying she was a prostitute that he was bringing to, like, a gull or something. So they wouldn't be so quick to say, yeah, but the guard could have a taste, too.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good scene because of the actors. But it was far too easy. And some of the action was a very staged. Like, the Cardassians on the mountain would wait to fire at Chief O'Brien so that he could turn around and fire back at them. It wasn't
and
a particularly
hit them with precision.
Yeah, it wasn't a particularly fast-paced or even in any way gritty or realistic action scene. But it was sold because old Kilmeany was brilliant in it. Especially the bit where he walks up to the force field and he turns it back on. And he kind of walks into it. Which was an excellent piece of acting from him when you think, obviously there was nothing there for him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just brilliant the way he walks and then kind of bounces off it. I thought it was a brilliant little touch.
Yeah, I think... See, this is the thing that always upsets me about the Next Generation and original series phaser fight scenes. With the phasers that the Federation have, they're beam weapons. You hit the button and a beam comes out. They're not like blasters from Star Wars where they're shooting just a bolt. You've got a beam. Hit that button, stay that beam, and then focus it in that person until you kill them. It drives me mad that they just shoot, and then if they miss, oops, well, I better shoot again. No, keep shooting.
Like a bullet.
Yeah, keep shooting until you track in that person. It's very simple. That's always bugged me about the Star Trek phasers. It's a beam. It's like a laser beam. Wait until it hits someone.
To try and no-prize that a little bit, maybe they're trained to do it that way to avoid burning out the power cell, because maybe they only have so much life to the beam before they'll burn it out.
Okay.
All right, I tried, I'm sorry.
It makes sense. It makes it more action-y, I guess. You know, that they can only fire once and they have to fire again, but that's just me being nitpicky.
Yeah, we set it on single beam because it's more exciting.
Well, you know, again, I hate to bring up the Abrams one, but they turned the Abrams phasers into basically Star Wars blasters. So there's another.
J.J. Abrams turned Star Trek into Star Wars.
Wow, that's surprising. That's never been said before, has it?
No.
Did I just come up with that concept? Wow.
Well, it's a remarkably startling thought.
I know it's
mind blown.
I don't know where I came up with that. That's hard to imagine.
Quark's brilliant in this one.
Oh, yes.
I love his rule of acquisition in this, which is something like every once in a while declare peace because it confuses your enemy.
Mm-hmm. And again, Odo and Quark, you know, are just, they're my favorite characters. They're the Rick and, Rick and Louie from Casablanca. They're perfect together. And yeah, Quark trying to get one over on Odo by telling him the truth for once is just great. And that's a great little scene. We'll have more little scenes, I think, later on in the episode or in the season with the two characters. It's just fun.
Did anybody see Morn?
You know, I will attest to this. I watched this episode three times. The opening scene is in Quark's, and there's like 4 or 5 minutes in Quark's where people are walking back and forth. I don't think I saw Morn in this episode once. I
didn't see him, and he's only in the next one very briefly.
Okay.
I specifically looked for him in that opening scene, as you did, three times.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not find him anywhere.
Every time there was a scene where it was set by the backdrop with people walking behind them, because if you actually watch that, you can see the same characters walk back and forth, because there's not, like, couple of hundred people on the station, so they just have people walk back and forth in the scene to keep motion going on behind there. Not once in this episode did I see Morn. So this is the first episode we've had where Morn isn't in the show, so I'm deeply saddened.
I'm looking on Memory Alpha where there have been episodes where I had trouble finding Morn, and I look on Memory Alpha and it'll say Morn, and then we record and you say, oh, this is where I found him. So you back them up. In this one, they don't have him listed as being on the show, and they list everybody. So I don't think it's that we missed him. I think he actually is not on this one, and I mourn that.
Every pun intended.
I love all the stuff about
Mourn's Mourn.
That's a while away, yeah. I love all the stuff on the station about the station being vandalized by the Bejor for Bajoran people, particularly O'Brien's reaction to it, which is, well, why are they vandalizing my station? I love that he thinks of it as his, because he's the one who has to keep it running. I can't mean he's great in this episode.
I think they finally found their footing with him. They found, you know, he's great as part of the ensemble, but you can't make him the focus.
Yeah, I agree. The whole thing where they're in ops and Sisko comes to him and said, we're going to need, you know, Major Kira's going to need a runabout. And he says, oh, is she going to Cardassia 4? And he's like, did she tell everyone on the station about this? And he goes, probably not Quark. I mean, they've got the characters down really well starting out this season. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to where things are going to be going from here.
Yeah, this is a, you know, again, you know, as you said, Andy, low key, but I think that's part of the beauty of it. It's, to reuse a term I use so often, it's a little bit of a slow burn. It's building you into it because they know, okay, we're doing a 3-part episode, but that's not all we're doing. We're building up into the season. We're going for not a season long story arc, but things that are going to continue throughout the season and things are going to get built on throughout the course of this series. And I just love the fact that they don't present issues as black and white. It isn't, okay, the Cardassians are bad, the Bajorans are good. You know, yeah, they do set up the Cardassians as the black hat wearing people. I mean, they're certainly not presented as all that sympathetic, but the Bajorans aren't portrayed as being completely blameless in things and completely white hat wearing either. You know, there's people in their own group who are hungry for power, and there's people who don't agree with how they're going to move on now that the Cardassian occupation is over. And it just creates so many layers that they could play with on the show, and they do. And I think, you know, this is, again, taking some things that went on last season and then building on it to make it a more, just a richer experience to watch.
I agree.
Ditto.
Well, do we have anything else we want to talk about for the show, or do we want to give it our ratings?
There was a nice little scene with Jake, who isn't really in the episode all that much, where apparently he started dating, and Sisko's like, oh, okay. That was a funny bit.
Oh yeah,
I like that he didn't want Sisko's advice. That was, you know, that was.
Yeah, you're obviously not ready to have this conversation, Dad.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job of portraying like a legitimate father son relationship, and they don't fall into a lot of the, just the stereotypical TV show things, and I like that. It's great when you get a cast like this, and they just. You know, okay, we'll give you, you know, 30 seconds of Jake, and then we'll get him off the screen, and you know, he'll get more time later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this isn't an episode about him, and you know, fair enough.
So I guess we're gonna rate this one now, and you know, I don't have my ratings from season one in front of me, so I'm starting this season blindly. Again, I thought this was a nice introduction to. To a 3-part show, a nice introduction to the season. I thought it gave us a lot of good acting, seriously good acting. And I'm actually going to bump it up from what I originally thought. I told you guys this. I always assign ratings, and then we talk about it, and then I give my rating. And if I don't say otherwise, it's my original rating. But in this instance, I had given it a 3.5. But just looking at the way it worked into everything, and as we're talking about it, I'm feeling a little bit more positive about it, and I'm going to give it 4.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead, Andy?
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything Paul said about this one. I think it's like we say, it's a low-key but interesting episode of the show. I'm gonna go 3.5. I'm not gonna go 4 because I think that the story gets a little bit better as it goes along. But the opening episode, yeah, solid 3.5.
Yeah, I kind of have to agree with Andy. I'm gonna go 3.5 as well. It was a good opener. The character, there's some good character moments in there. There's better ones that come up. I like the addition of a Bajoran protagonist in Frank Langella as Minister Charo. I think the character of Lee Nollis would have been really well suited if he would have continued on the show. On, you know, spoilers, I don't think he's going to be around for all that long. But yeah, overall, a good opening to the second season. Again, not as great as the pilot, but it was hard to beat that first pilot episode for Deep Space Nine.
All right. I guess time to move on to some email?
Yep, let's go ahead and do some email.
Incoming transmission.
I have to actually open my emails. So.
Okay. Do you want me to do the first one? The one from Gene?
That would be wonderful.
Okay. Well, this first one we have comes from our good friend Gene, the podcasting machine Hendrix, and he writes in with the title Battle Lines. He says, Sean, Paul, and Andy, take that for whatever sequential order you want.
You paired him.
Well, I did offer to come on his Legend of the Superhero shows, and I had to talk about the Green Lantern movie, so I guess that was payment enough. He says, I'm going to comment on the Trek 3 news, as I'm not going to see it anyway, so it has no effect on me. So I guess he could care less about Trek 3. Fine and well and good. He says, as the episode, as Andy would say, and Paul did, it's all right. Yes, we get some interesting background info on Kira, but it seems like we're retreading stuff we already know. It's a good setup for the storyline down the road of the Vedics fighting over the Kai position, but it wasn't anything stellar. Kira's emotions are on quote-unquote high this time out, and I felt it wasn't earned, especially with the Kai being killed. If we had seen more of a spiritual side of her in prior episodes, I would buy it more, but this is just coming out of left field. To use Sean's analogy, this was someone who we've not seen being devout, all of a sudden breaking down as if she was devout at the death of a spiritual leader. I do agree that Dax wasn't used properly in this one. She was suffering from McCoy syndrome in that they needed a quote-unquote dumb character, and she drew the short straw. I can overlook a needle in the haystack thing by thinking that the Trill didn't use metallic needles and that Dax has never seen a human seamstress. Yeah, it's a stretch, but it works for me. Gene. I guess that's kind of a no prize for Dax not getting the reference of, you know, the whole trying to find a needle in a haystack thing. But, you know, you would think that being, what, 300 years old, she might have heard that euphemism before and had it explained to her. But, you know, that was just one of the negative things about the episode, the poor portrayal of Dax in that.
Maybe she knows Darmok and she's not familiar with metaphor.
There you go.
Or she's the opposite of Darmok, excuse me. But yeah, I agree.
yeah, I don't disagree with any of that.
Okay, there you go.
At which point, I guess we'll move on to email number 2. Do you want me to do it?
Yeah, because mine's not letting me in, so I can't see him.
Okay.
And that's from our friend Luke Giaconetti, who sends an email. It's titled, Curse the Falling Rain, the Vortex of Pain. Listen to the Prophets 11 and 12. Dear Space Niners, hey guys, wanted to send you a quick line to talk about the last few episodes, Vortex and Battle Lines. I have not seen either of these episodes, but I did enjoy listening to the discussions around them, tangents and all. It seems like DS9 is still getting its footing in these early episodes, which is not surprising. I am continually amazed when we fanboys complain that a new genre series is not exactly on point out of the gate, only to champion said series once it has a season or so under its belt and finds its groove. At this point, I think we should all just collectively agree that with a genre show, we should just give it a season to work the kinks out before judging it. It happens too frequently to be coincidental. I do find it funny that on Vortex, you have a whole bit of false history introduced for the changelings, which eventually ties in somewhat. This is amusing considering the seat-of-the-pants nature of the story arcs on the series. If made nowadays, one can imagine that all of Odo's backstory would be mapped out by the showrunners, and that they would be bragging about it in interviews. Snarky hipster genre TV producer voice. Oh yeah, we have it all worked out on a series of whiteboards here in the office. It's all there, and if you follow it real close, you can see the pieces come together.
As opposed to Lost, where they told us that, but we're lying through their teeth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that really left a sour taste in my mouth for a series that I loved as it was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. This is not a Lost podcast.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, you'd be sat here talking to yourself, I think.
I also really liked the Cliff DeYoung mini-episode. DeYoung was also in the 80s horror film The Hunger, popped up in an episode of The New Twilight Zone, and was a personal favorite of mine from childhood. Disney's Flight of the Navigator. He was also in the 90s horror movie Dr. Giggles with Larry Drake and Holly Marie Combs. The Skateboard Kid, and even in an episode of The Pretender. Coming soon on 2-2 Freaks, Cliff DeYoung Monthly Monday. Battle Lines does sound like a Next Generation episode from the story and the direction. Any chance that this was a TNG episode that got ported over to DS9? I would say very possible. I believe things like that went down in this era because Paramount was still accepting pitches for TNG episodes. All in all, sounds like an unremarkable installment. Once again, part of the finding its footing here in the first season. I do have to raise a question. You have an episode entitled Vortex, and the song you use is Come Sail Away. What? How can you make that choice when there's a substantially better song out there called Vortex by Megadeth? I mean, seriously. Yeah, it's off of Cryptic Writings, but still. Keep up the good work on these episodes I have never seen. Luke. Well, obviously, Come Sail Away is there because of Dennis DeYoung.
Well, and also because, you know, unfortunately, even though I podcast with Luke, getting together with him whenever we do shows like The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, it's always him and Hero who are going back and forth about them going to all these metal concerts, going to see Iron Maiden and going to see Metallica and Megadeth and all this, and they're really into that. And unfortunately, I lived in a small town where it was all just classic rock. So Led Zeppelin and Lynyrd Skynyrd and stuff like that was what I heard. And I never got into the hard metal stuff. So I had no idea that Megadeth had a song called Vortex. I will send you a list of upcoming episodes, Luke. And if you have suggestions for opening songs that might fit in with the episode, you can hit me up with an email and I would be more than happy to use them. Because, yeah, I just picked out, oh, Cliff DeYoung, Dennis DeYoung, boom, Come a Sail Away, done.
Also, we didn't mention that this episode was a Next Generation idea that Michael Piller stole for Deep Space Nine.
Oh, there you go.
This one that we've just talked about, not the one in the email.
Oh, okay.
The Homecoming?
Yeah. It was originally pitched as a Next Generation episode about a generic Bajoran leader and... Ensign Roe was the one who wanted to go and bring him back to Bajor to bring stability to the region, and Michael Piller saw it and bought it off Jerry Taylor and said, no, I think we can do better with this on Deep Space Nine.
Interesting. I had no idea.
I would assume that if it would have been the Next Generation episode, it would have just been a one-off episode and they wouldn't have developed it as much as they did.
Yeah, and I don't think it went to complete script. I think it was a pitch Jerry Taylor did and he just bought it off of for DS9 and then he gave it to the writers of this three-parter and said, right, do what you want with it. But that's our starting point.
Well, going back to Luke's email, I do have to agree that, yeah, it is a trope of fans for us to gripe and complain about the first season being bad or not having its footing, and you know,
except for Firefly.
Well, unfortunately Firefly only had its one season, but Firefly is like the exception to the rule. Most genre shows, even I'm certain, well, maybe even The Flash, because The Flash has been really good on the first season. But you look at Next Gen, you look at Arrow, you know, even Constantine, a lot of the shows start out kind of weak, and it's not until they progress to a second or third season that they actually start gelling together. So Deep Space Nine was really no different.
See, I don't know I agree with that, because the original Star Trek's first season is brilliant.
Well, but that was, you know, I think that was a different time. That was before, you know, it was very groundbreaking, the genre episode, and they're in genre TV. Nowadays, we've got shows like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and, you know, The Flash, and, you know, even stuff like Supernatural and Buffy and Angel that may not really work in the first season, but eventually progress as characters get, or as actors get more comfortable with the characters.
I think we could sit and just go round and round in circles about this, because I think for every example people always put up as taking a season to find its feet, there's one where you go, well, actually, Buffy was brilliant from the get-go, and so was Angel. And so was Supernatural. In fact, Supernatural was better in its first season than it is now. I don't disagree with what people say to it, but sometimes I think when producers say it, I think they're just being lazy.
Well, that could
really
be
do.
It.
I mean, I don't think Deep Space Nine took an entire season to get going, really. I think its pilot hit the ground running, and then it kind of stumbled a little bit as it thought this was just going to be the next generation on a space station. But they very quickly realized that wasn't working. And I certainly think by the time we get to the back end of the first season, they're off and sprinting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
they couldn't have done this episode as the second season opener if the first season was utter toss.
Yeah, and if
because
they had,
there's so much here that builds on what they were doing in the last half of season one. Sorry, Sean.
No, if they hadn't developed the idea of the political turmoil on Bajor, as well as you know, Sisko killing off the Kai by taking her through the wormhole and letting her get killed on this planet, yeah, then nothing for the second season would be set up to have this sort of conflict going on Bajor. So, yeah, I guess we could go round and round about that.
We could just go, yeah, because Babylon 5 is another one. Everyone says, well, the first season's not very good. The first season pisses all over season 5. I'm sorry, but it does.
Well, but you have to admit, season 5 of Babylon 5 was not planned. They kind of figured that...
Come on! For 5 years he banged on about his 5-year plan for the show.
He banged on about that until the CBS or whoever was going to said, we're not going to do a fifth season. And then he said, we've got to wrap it up in the fourth season. And then they saw how well the fourth season did and said, oh, we'll give you a fifth season after he wrapped everything up. So
another network picked it up for syndication
and
asked for the fifth season, but on a very reduced budget.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I think the fact that he was obsessed with doing 22 episodes hurt him. He should have said, all right, we'll do a fifth season, but we'll do less episodes.
Yeah,
because the fifth season's awful.
Well, but, you know, and this was also a time where 22 episodes was pretty much the norm, and it wasn't like...
Yeah, very, very few people were doing 13-episode seasons then.
Yeah, that was more a UK standard type thing. That's usually where I think when these shortened seasons, the 13-episode seasons, that's where I usually initially think that they came from, is from the UK. And the American television networks suddenly decided to adopt that because it allows for tighter episodes and less fluff in the episode. So,
yeah, well, it's just the business model, wasn't it? Your business model was designed around making enough episodes for syndication. That's mm-hmm. all it was. We didn't have that.
Yep. So there you go. All right. Well, guys, thanks for writing in. We really appreciate it. If you guys would like to write into the show, the email address is listentotheprophets@gmail.com. Write into the show. We'll read it on the next episode we get recorded, and we love hearing from the listeners. So is
both
there... yes, both Gene and Luke. You guys are the greatest.
We have at least one other listener.
Oh, yeah. We've got Dewey, don't we? In fact, don't we have a...
Dewey.
Don't we have an email from him later, maybe? I think, I don't
know.
All right, well, there we go. Well, do we have anything else that we want to say about this one, or are we good to go?
I didn't know we had an email from Dewey.
Or Dewey? Oh, that was a pun. Oh, no, it's Paul.
I don't think
Paul
we
in Greensboro. That's who it is. I'm sorry, it's Paul in Greensboro. I was thinking of someone else. Well, that's what I get for mouthing off. Okay, Andy, take us out, please. Keep me from...
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, the man who created the $7 man. $7 million man. The $7 man, that's a completely different show.
That's me.
The man who created $7 million man writes an episode of Deep Space Nine that not only has that parent, has that going for it, but also has the guy in it who was very nearly Captain Picard. If that doesn't make you tune in, nothing will.
It's going to make me tune in. Of course,
I'll watch.
Have to be here next time. All right.
You caught me off guard, though, with the next time. Completely forgot I was supposed to do that.
Oops. How many episodes have we been doing this?
I know, but we've had a month off.
That's true, we have.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Off and it all goes to pot.
That works.
You know, we forgot to talk about the Gul Dukat scene, which was actually.
We didn't mention Mark Alamo comes back.
Yeah, we can just. I'll put this in the outtakes. You know, we can talk about that because that was brilliant. You know, when Kira comes back after the rescue and she thinks she's going to get dressed down by Sisko and everyone, she says, "I'd like you to come in here." And Gul Dukat's in there. We'd like to apologize. We didn't know about this, and we're sending all the people home healthy and happy.
He also leaves you wondering, because just the way he always portrays it, he leaves you wondering, does he have some kind of ulterior motive here? Is he doing something behind the scenes to screw them over while they think they're getting what they want? There's just, you know, there's so much more to him.
I thought he was definitely doing that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
I thought he was definitely doing that. There's no way in hell he didn't know that was going on.
But you're wondering if in them giving up the prisoners that were, still there, are they somehow, you know, okay, you got us and we're giving in and, you know, we'll pretend like we didn't know? Or is it, this is exactly what we wanted and now we're getting our way, but we'll pretend like you're winning? Like, there's always something about him, like, it makes you say, when he says he'll do what you want, you start saying to yourself, I don't know if I want that now.
Yeah.
He's the seller that gives you buyer's remorse on every turn.
Well, and it's the sort of sly way that Mark Alamo plays it, that you just can't be certain if he's actually being conciliatory or whether he's being scheming. And it's just great. He personifies the idea of the Cardassians. The Cardassians are some of the best Star Trek villains, because they're not just, you know that they're bad, but they do it with such a smile, and, you know, they're like the government. You know that the government's going to screw you, but they come in there with a smile and try and be helpful. It's amazing. I've just isolated everyone. Everyone now thinks I'm a crazy right winger. There you go.
All our government listeners are out.
Yeah, all of the people who tuned in for our incredible, well thought out and well reasoned discussion of the political process in the United States and the UK.
Right now, Barack Obama is slamming his iPod down, saying, "I'm done downloading this f***ing show."
Do you know? I think he listens.
Yeah. Well, you know, he'll listen to this one because we praised, Leonard Nimoy at the beginning. So there you go. You know, we appreciate you listening, President Obama. Thank you very much.
We do. We appreciate the President of the United States doesn't have anything better to do.
Sure that my Skype recorder is working. Check that the thing is...
Check that the thing is thinging.
The thing is thinging?
Is the thing thinging? Because that's important. I gotta make sure my thing is thinging.
It's too early for your thing to be thinging.
Yeah. That's why you have Cialis. Okay.
For daily use.
I can't think of anything, really. I've been looking online to see if there's anything that I get on Facebook, little Star Trek pop-ups, but there are nothing major that's going on. It's like, oh, who's had a birthday? What captain would you like to be? And the answer is always Kirk, dumbass.
Yeah, there is no other answer, is there?
No. Really?